Welcome to Church of the Incarnation's Sermon Podcast. For service times and more information about us, please visit incarnation.org.
May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. The parable of the Good Samaritan is a story about the birth of compassion. It is about the gestation and the inception of human compassion. A particular calamity happened to a particular man as he was going up, down actually, to Jericho from the city of Jerusalem. And two individuals pass by him, and each of them walks to the other side so as to avoid engagement with this particular instance of the suffering of the human race. This instance of suffering of which you are one, exactly one. And in this case, it's this poor fellow who's been beaten up and left for dead. The first character that passes him by is a priest. Now, the priest represents power insofar as in this context, those who had been elected priests had enormous power politically and ecclesiastically. We're told that when Jesus kind of began to shake the tree of divine absolution and mercy, the priests took counsel how to, what's the word we use today, off him? No, what's the word? It was used recently about a well-known 29-year-old. Disappear him. Now, the priest represents power, and power is a kind of a force in the world that is actually quite impersonal. Democrats can have it. Republicans can have it. Episcopalian bishops can have it. Presbyteries can have it. The city hall can have it. And a trade union can have it. Power is something that is an end in itself, whether you're young or old or whatever your ethnicity is. Power can go to your head and also destroy you like that. Now, whether you think that Edward Snowden is a traitor or a whistleblower, whether, and there's divided opinions on that subject, we do know that our country exercised power in seeing that President Morales' plane was grounded. I've been to Bolivia not long ago, and a priest told me, well, Paul, now you're at the end of the line. He told me. He spent his entire career in Bolivia. Paul, now you're at the end of the line. And power is what, when you have it, you use it as much as you possibly can. It's an impersonal force. Now, maybe you're married to a passive-aggressive man. That was a. Let's just imagine that you're married to a passive aggressive man. Now, that man has extraordinary power. A matter of fact, a passive aggressive man has all the cards in a marriage because everybody, including his children and his wife most of all, spend their entire term with him walking on eggshells. Power, and you know what? Like McDonald's, he's loving it. Now, maybe you have a teenage daughter who's touchy. She's got all the power. Your entire adolescence of hers, walking on eggshells, afraid to say the wrong thing. Power loves it, it holds it, and it gives nothing away. Maybe you have a 2-year-old, and he's loving it. because you're spoiling him, you're scared of him, you're threatened by his putative tantrums, and you'll do anything to appease him. He's loving it. He's got the power, just as much as our country exercised it, for better or for worse, exercised it in relationship to President Morales. Power gives nothing away. And so the priest here represents power, and power is not going to be, for a moment, giving anything away that won't reward itself. So the power in the equation steps to the left and continues on his way. Now there is a second character in the story. He is called the Levite. Now, historically, the Levites were blood members of the tribe of Israel who had the right to be a priest. A priest was always elected from the Levites. You could be a Levite and not be a priest, but you couldn't be a priest and not be a Levite. Now, the Levites in this story represent categorical thinking, because the Levite says to himself, I'm a Levite. My sister is a Levite, and Matthias over there is a Levite. But who is this? Plus, he's got blood on him, so he's impure, and I cannot touch him. Now, how does that translate to you and me? Categorization. People do it all the time. You say to yourself, you're just like your father. You know, you are just like your sister. I've just had it with you. You categorize. Liberals have been doing this for centuries. Don't misunderstand. That's not a political statement. I'll give you an example. When I was in college, it was 68, and everyone was totally wildly involved in the hippie revolution, and I had a very close friend from school who was always waking up early in the morning to throw stones at the corporation of the college when they met three times a year. And he was a totally invested person in categorization. You were a capitalist pig or you were good. So one day I come to him, and I say, look, will you take me in your Volkswagen van out to Wellesley? If I don't get out to Wellesley this afternoon, my relationship with so-and-so is over. And he says, are you kidding? I have to go demonstrate in favor of. Now, do you understand? He was living a life of categorization. He was all about groups and types and people who looked like what he thought was bad or good. But in the particular instances of acute suffering, me, he chose to walk on the other side. And this is what categorization is. Whenever you hear the word demographic, run as far as you can. People are using that a lot now about this state or other states. They'll talk about changing demographics. That is journalistic thinking. Do you consider yourself part of a demographic? You're just the person that you are. And it may be that you're lying in the middle of the road. Not everyone sees it today, but you've got a problem, and it's urgent. So, have you been the victim of categorization? If you ever went to high school, you were. By definition, you were the victim of categorization. And have you ever been the victim of power, especially at work? Do you know how many men in this particular room have been betrayed at work? How many men in their 50s or 60s or even their 40s were the victims of a power play in a company or an academic institution or some kind of an organization? Probably half of my listeners here today have been the victims at some point of a power play. Now, what births compassion in the person of the Good Samaritan? Well, there's actually an answer to that question. And, you know, it's the answer to me and you having the least bit of compassion to the sufferer with whom you live, or the sufferer whom you actually know. The Samaritan was a member of a group of people who had been the victims of a power play and of categorization for many years. Mary and I have been to Samaria twice. And if you're a good Samaritan, you have to wear a red hat if you're a man. It's the custom. It identifies you as a Samaritan. You look like a red cap in Grand Central Station in 1952. I always feel like I'm in a Hitchcock movie when I go to Samaria. Now, Samaritans, because there had been a problem with the bloodlines during the Babylonian captivity, and there had been miscegenation with non-Jews during a time when most of the Jews had been exiled, had a reputation for being, they were categorized as being segregatable. And so they were all segregated in a little section called Samaria. This is why Jesus always had to skirt Samaria. He had to always walk around Samaria, because that's where the impure ersatz Jews were. They'd also been the victims of power, because they had, they're on bus lines, and they couldn't be in the army. They were entirely a group of people who were sort of the scourge of the land. And so, isn't it interesting that it is the Samaritan and not the priest and not the Levite with his standing in whom compassion was birthed for this poor chap at the middle of the road? He knew what it was like in his heart to be powerless, to be on a downed airplane and not be the president of France. He understood about categorization. And so he was, you might say, completely free to identify with an individual sufferer who needs to get to Wellesley College. He was not caught up in his head. Now, it is possible to be a sufferer and to be terrible. I mean, a lot of poor people are awful. I mean, they're sufferers, but they're so full of anger. I hope you understood what I said. You can be a victim and yet be so full of anger that you have absolutely no compassion upon your whoever he or she happens to be. And you can also be kind of acquiescent but deeply resentful. I mean, some of you know about that. You accept a situation, but you're bitter. But what makes the Samaritan such an emblematic example for you and me is that he's obviously completely in touch with powerlessness and categorizability, and yet is free to love someone like himself. Now, my last illustration to illustrate this, because why am I doing this up here? I'm trying to identify you with someone who's been checkmated by a powerful man. May have been your second husband. I'm talking about you who have been treated as if you're a part of a group, but you're not. All you are is you. Why do you treat me like somebody in this group when all I am is little old me trying to get through difficult life? You have to be in touch with your sufferings to really be compassionate. And look, I'm talking to you. The closer you can come to tears, the closer you can actually really feel the checkmatedness of your life, whatever form it takes, that is a very important, burning cause of personal change. Now, my last illustration is something I like. In February 1961... on a Friday night at 9 o'clock, you might have been watching The Twilight Zone. The Twilight Zone is from 9 to 9:30 on CBS every Friday night in February 1961. Rod Serling, who was very religious, people don't know this about him, he was very religious. He wrote an episode of The Twilight Zone called Equality of Mercy. And in this episode, some U.S. Marines on Okinawa in August of 1945, are exhausted, and they come across a group of wounded, out of ammunition, fanatical Japanese infantry holed up in a cave. And a very gung-ho lieutenant says, "Let's go in and kill them. We can take them. It's still war. There are enemies." And all the soldiers say, "Hey, Sarge, we're bushed. We're tired. The war's almost over. Why don't we just bypass them? They don't even have 5 cartridges between them." And he says, "No, they're the bad guys. We got to go." And suddenly, the Twilight Zone intervenes. And Dean Stockwell, the gung-ho lieutenant, blinks his eyes, and he's become a Japanese corporal. And he finds himself as a tired, humane Japanese corporal on Corregidor 3 years earlier. And he's in a unit of well-armed, numerous Japanese soldiers who are being bonsaied by their lieutenant to charge a group of wounded Americans holed up in a cave without any ammunition, not going to surrender, U.S. Marines on Corregidor in a cave. In other words, the roles have completely switched, and it occurs to him the mammoth character of his own bloody-mindedness. And then, boop, he's back on Okinawa in 1945. And they tell him, hey, Lieutenant, they just dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima. The war is over. And he sort of looks at the camera saying, what? And that's the end. Well, now think about that. Now, you see, that's you. That's the Good Samaritan. That lieutenant understands about defeat and power and categorization because he's been on the opposite end. So look, I conclude this sermon by just asking you that if you're having a little hard of a time loving somebody who's really challenging that you live with. Now, nobody here has anybody, but you know somebody who does. If you're having a hard time having compassion on an emotionally recidivistic wife or an impossible child or a really, really alienating three-year-old, come into contact with the part of you that has been overwhelmed by massive power or wildly excluded on the basis of an arbitrary conceptualization. And you will, I assure you, be able to love that poor Joe who happens to be in your house. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.